So this is Article 2 of the UUA bylaws. Let's start up there at 2.1. This is where our principles are. I imagine that they are familiar to most of you at this point, of which we have 7 principles. Then next are our 6 sources. So this is all part of the section 2.1. On the back side of this sheet, 2.2 is the purposes. Which, unless you're a minister, I imagine maybe you've never read that before. It's fairly straightforward. It says the UUA is going to devote its resources and corporate powers for religious, educational, humanitarian purposes, and that the purpose of the association is to serve the needs of its member congregations, organize new congregations, extend and strengthen UU institutions. Then 2.3 is a statement on inclusion. And then 2.4, a statement on the freedom of belief. So as you'll come to see, some of these things will change quite a bit in the proposed form, some will not. But let's stop there with this handout for now. That this is where we're starting. This is what we currently have. How did we get this? We have to go all the way back to the time of merger in 1961. And in fact, Section 2.1 here, about the principles and the sources, is why the merger nearly didn't happen. The compromises that had to be made to make the merger happen remain evident right here in these bylaws, in the sources in particular. Would it not be fair to say that in our sources there's a bit of ambivalence? Does that seem a fair thing to say? Because on the one hand, we could say that the sources contain everything, direct experience, secular humanism, a variety of world religions. But yet on the other hand, we might ask the question, why are some world religions listed, specifically Judaism, Christianity, and then later earth-based religions? So why are some listed and others aren't? And in naming some, aren't we then giving them a privileged position? Revisions came to this Article 2 in 1985 at the request of women UUs to address sexist language. So where it now says things like humans and humanity and so forth, initially it did not, it said man. So that was fixed in 1985. The 6th source about earth-based religions, that was added in the 90s, and that came from people with that theology. We had gained enough people with that theology in the 90s who felt they wanted it added. My point being that Article 2 here is essentially a transcript of our history. First, how UUism was made, and then how it's been adapted and reformed over time. Some people might say, well, the word transcript is too uncritical. Some people might say it's more like a fossil or a relic. That, in other words, is something more appropriate to 6 decades ago than it is to today. Here is what the Article 2 Study Commission report had to say about growing discontent in UUism about Article 2. Quote, our current principles and purposes were last substantially revised in 1985. At General Assembly 2017, there was discussion of amending the principles to add an 8th principle addressing racism and an amended 1st principle addressing non-human life. The 5th principle was the subject of a report in 2009, which dealt with the ways in which General Assembly and other Unitarian Universalist gatherings do and don't embody an inclusive democratic practice or process. The 7th principle has also been the subject of discussions about possible amendments, end quote. Now, one thing I want to make clear here is that the expressions of discontent that have been made about the principles in Article 2 is coming from both the top and the bottom. So, in most UU congregations, there's a some discontent among a handful of folks about how the UUA is always making us do stuff. The UUA can't really make us do anything. It says right in our bylaws in Article 1 that we're a congregationalist faith and that congregations are in charge of their own affairs. But in this case, not only is it not a UUA thing, it's not all coming from the top, it's also coming from the bottom. The changes that were made in the 1980s came from women UUs. Pagans demanded the addition of the sixth source. UU Animal Ministry created the first principle project in the 20-teens. So in other words, I would call this a both and. It's, yes, it's partly denominational and coming from the top, but it's also congregational and coming from the bottom. So it's grassroots pressure and the denomination working together. So with this rumblings of discontent from both the top and the bottom, in 2020, the UUA board created a study commission. And this was the charge that the UUA gave to the study commission. This is a fairly lengthy quote. "The new principles and purposes should guide us in the transformation of ourselves, our communities, and our faith into active networks of collective care, restoration, and justice. The principles and purposes you will prepare should be a living document," and this is a side outside the quote. The study report emphasizes living document over and over again. Right? So for people who are like, I don't want change, they're making the point over and over again that that is intrinsic to UU. It's why we're non-creedal, right? The idea is we're constantly open to revision and reform. Okay, so back to the quote. "The principles and purposes you will prepare should be a living document that challenge Unitarian Universalists to place the liberation in all its dimensions of all at the center of our lives. They should be honest about our past, name what we are facing, and our aspirations and where we hope to be, not just for today, but looking out at the horizons. They should ask us to choose love and action as the path forward. Further, the commission shall decenter habitual practices that reinforce white supremacy culture. We also note that there is a growing urging for us to better articulate our recognition of rights of being for all beings. The board would like to see an Article 2 that is inspirational, memorable, and poetic. The language should be inclusive and welcoming and explicitly anti-racist." End of the quote. So that started in 2020. The UUA board created a study commission. They gave him that charge that I just read. The commission began with 45 feedback sessions that had 4,600 participants. They had videos that reached 7,800 viewers, and they did 29 surveys with roughly 11,000 responses. And I was one of them. Maybe some of you were as well. So from all of that, those feedback sessions, the surveys and such, the study commission felt that a number of commonalities rose to the surface among all those responses. One commonality was a desire for change. And you might say, well, the people who most wanted the change were probably the ones who filled out the surveys. Maybe, except I also know a whole bunch of people who were opposed to change and make sure that they also got their voices in on the survey. So I think that that was probably a wash in terms of who was most passionate about what. All right, so commonality number one, a desire for change. Commonality number two was a sense that the principles implied a shared worldview and a set of ethics, but could state it far more explicitly. A third commonality is that the current Article 2 asks congregations to affirm and promote the principles. But many people felt that that really wasn't much of an ask. So in other words, if we want to be an association and a movement that has impact at the national level, then we really need to create a much stronger covenant between the congregations and the movement as a whole, and that maybe that requires a bigger ask than affirm and promote. And then a fourth commonality that emerged is that it became clear that our bylaws have a greater weight on them than would be true of bylaws of your average organization. And it's because we don't have a creed. So a lot of what other organizations and churches would use a creed for, we also use these bylaws for. So they have a social function. They unify us. They have an evangelical function when we talk about this and presenting ourselves to others. They have a personal function. We use them for ethics and values. They have an educational function. We use these for teaching. And they have a rhetorical function, that we use them to define ourselves in public and legal contexts. So with these concerns, the study commission worked for the next 2 years to create a draft Article 2. That's what's on your second page here. So let's take a look at it. So purposes previously was the second section. Now it's been moved to the first. It's not terribly different. I don't know if it's word for word. I didn't try to match it word for word, but it essentially says the same thing. That we're an organization devoted to religious, educational, and humanitarian purposes. The big changes are in 2.2. Was previously 2.1 in the other one, where our principles and our sources were. So now, there are no principles in this draft, and there are no sources. Well, let me rephrase that. There are no principles. There's sources in a different way in the next section. But the principles are gone in a sense that some of that language of the principles is preserved here in this document. But the principles as we know them are being transformed. So here's their rationale. They said at the heart of UUism is love. And in our Facebook group yesterday, I posted an image of that. So they created an image kind of like a flower with love at the center. And then these six values that are on your document as a petal around those things. So the idea is at the heart of UU is love. And then these values are what we hold in common. And they all essentially are undergirding love. So these values are interdependence, pluralism, justice, transformation, generosity, equity. Now, if you look closely, for instance, if you go to the interdependence one, so it's one word, and their rationale was that it's a whole lot easier to remember and to communicate to others a word instead of a sentence or two principle. But we also want to explain and amplify what that value is. And to do so, they used a lot of the words from the principles. So interdependence, you'll recognize the first sentence. We honor the interdependent web of all existence. Guess what? Right? That's one of the principles. And it's, in fact, it's in our covenant as well. So if you look closely at the language there in the values, some of it is going to seem quite familiar because it's the language of the principles now built around values, one word values. The next section, section 2.3. What was our sources is now being referred to as inspirations. So this section says, as you use, we use and are inspired by sacred and secular understandings that help us live into our values. We respect the histories, contexts, and cultures in which they were created and are currently practiced. These sources ground us and sustain us in ordinary, difficult, and joyous times. Grateful for the religious ancestries we inherit and diversity which enriches our faith, we are called to ever deepen and expand our wisdom. So our sources as they were, as I suggested earlier, are essentially everything, but it does privilege some things over others and naming some and not naming others. This one is simplifying it and saying that we are inspired by pretty much everything. Some of it's sacred, some of it's secular. So it's saying something similar. We're inspired by pretty much everything you can name, but in this case, it's just leaving it at that in a generalized fashion and not naming some things and not naming others. And then the final two sections there, inclusion. Prior, on the previous version, this was called, well, also called inclusion. You'll notice that this language is not a radical departure, but rhetorically a little bit stronger. And that's on purpose, and I'll talk more about that in a moment. And then it concludes with a statement on a freedom of belief, and the words are different, but the spirit of it is essentially the same as before. All right, so what happens next? So this initiative is overlapping with the eighth principle. And when I was on my way here today, I couldn't remember if I had done a sermon here about the eighth principle or not. I know I've done a sermon on the eighth principle. I couldn't remember where. Did we do that here? No? Okay. So the eighth principle was a grassroots initiative created by people of color several years back. Their argument was that, from their point of view, Article 2 did not address the concerns of people of color and anti-racism enough. They felt like we needed an eighth principle to be much more explicit about that. So the eighth principle is very much, I don't have the exact wording in my head, but it's a fully anti-racist statement that you use, we commit to the creation of the above community, through the dismantling of racism, something along those lines. So that eighth principle is on a different timeline than this. Right? They were two different processes. The eighth principle is coming up for a vote at this General Assembly coming up in June. So if it receives enough votes, and I believe it needs to get a two-thirds or three-quarters vote, if it gets enough votes, then it'll be added to our current principles. And we'll have eight. This business, the Article 2, is also coming up for a vote in June, but this vote is just a vote to put it on the docket for serious consideration over the course of the year, and then it'll come up for a real vote the next year. So to be considered, it needs to just get a majority at this coming General Assembly. Right, then there'll be a whole year of discussion. It'll come up for a vote again, and it'll need a three-quarter vote in order to be approved. Okay, so there could be a time where we have eight principles for a year, and then a year later we have no principles. That could happen. Right? Or we could end up approving an eighth principle, and then this is rejected, and we'll keep eight principles. Or maybe there won't be an eighth principle, but we'll approve this, right? You get the idea. They're on different timelines. One of the masterminds behind the eighth principle was also on the study commission, and her name is Paula Cole Jones. And I watched a video clip where she was asked, well, what about the eighth principle? She was on the study commission encouraging this and the abandonment of the principles. But doesn't she care about the eighth principle anymore? And her response was that the whole reason behind the eighth principle was to get the entire movement to be more explicitly anti-racist. And she said that in consulting with Black Lives of UU and diverse revolutionary UU ministries and the other groups that are devoted to the interests of people of color, and consulting with them, they felt that the new Article 2 is more anti-racist, and that they feel that addressed their concerns sufficiently enough that it doesn't need extra special principles or anything additionally. So they would still like to see the eighth principle approved this year, just in case this isn't approved, but they feel like the anti-racist concerns are addressed in the new Article 2. So the reason all this matters is because this congregation gets two votes. I think that's right, two delegates. So we all need to let them know how we want them to vote. they're going to have at least two important things to vote on. One is, do we want to approve the eighth principle now? And then secondly, do we want to send Article 2 out into UUDM for the next year for consideration for potential approval a year from now? So what I'm going to suggest we do is, why don't we form up into some small groups, turn to our neighbors, and let's have some conversations and discussion on this Article 2 business. And after we do that for a while, Annie's going to walk around the microphone around if anyone has some thoughts they would like to share with the whole. So go ahead and chat it up.
Back to like it, based on what I'd heard, but I am pleasantly surprised. And I think they've done a fabulous job of capturing the criticisms in all kinds of ways. One of the things we pointed out was that, you know, there have been criticisms that the seventh, the Earth-based, you know, respect for our Earth and interdependent web shouldn't be last, it should be first. And they've moved it first. And one of the points Neil made was that it was, that it still has individual beliefs are still sacrosanct, that we were afraid that there would be a little imposing the party line from above, and that really does not appear to be the case. So I'm stoked that they have done a good job here.
Now mine's more of a question than an answer or anything. Something I was curious about is how often a source or a principle has been amended rather than added. Because something that you talked about is how with the anti-race one, it's a bit too specific and it could lead to more principles, but that's going to lead to a ton of principles. So I'm curious if a principle has ever been amended to make it more inclusive, or if it's ever changed like the dynamic of it.
Other than addressing the sexist language of them in the 80s, they haven't been changed, the principles.
Because an eighth one, if they could add the eighth one and then potentially change it, or it's going to lead to a ninth, a tenth, and 11th for other different groups that don't feel recognized.
The proponents of the eighth principle would say that we need it now, and that in the future, maybe we won't need it, and the eighth one could go away. Or maybe there will be something else in the future that requires a ninth one. But then, yeah, that does beg the question, how many do we get to add or not?
That was my point behind it, is that my thought process on this is I do like the new proposal for Article 2. The inclusion part of it, I think, leaves it open, and you know, it goes into identities, ages, abilities, and histories, so it's kind of very broad. I don't have an issue with anti-racism, absolutely, but I do have an issue with anything being too specific, because when we get too specific on something, then it's what about me, what about me? And I think to foster inclusion, we have to make sure that we're not doing something that is exclusive. You know what I mean? So for an anti-racism principle, what about people with mental health issues? What about the LGBTQ who are actively being attacked right now? What about us? What about us? What about us? What about us? You know, we put something specifically in there for a particular group of people, then we're not being inclusive. That's actually the opposite of inclusion. That was my thought process on article, or on the eighth principle. You know, something that is, you know, very inclusive. Like, I do like the way that they wrote inclusion in here. I think it is very broad and open to any outlying group of people. So that was kind of my thought process behind it.
Do you want the party line response? If you're raising that question, you're part of the white supremacist problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I get it.
Mm-hmm. That would be the party line response.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, there are other groups like for disability awareness and so on who have said that we get that our issue matters just as much, but I'm okay with us putting something on the front burner for a time. That doesn't mean I have to go to the back burner. It just means we're putting something on the front burner.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I understand that piece of it.
I'm not saying that one group's problems are more important than another group's problems, and that's exactly my point, is that, you know, to be inclusive, we need to make sure that we're being inclusive and we're not adding something in that is exclusive. You know what I mean?
Interesting discussion. I'm getting lost in it.
I had something that I was going to say, and that it also fits directly in response to that as well. I do think it is, I like that it steps back to be a more overarching, and I think allows for the individual congregations to choose of the elements of diversity, where is this group specifically more passionate right now, and where does it fit? I also want to be very cognizant and kind of call out the elephant in the room, I think, a little bit when talking about anti-racism, that we're really white. Like, I mean, we are a group of a white congregation talking about should there be an anti-racist eighth principle or not, and our conversation is just going to inherently be different than a congregation that does have some larger presence of people of color than our congregation might have, and it should. We should have those different conversations and be willing to recognize that. For me, what I think is just so incredibly, I'm going to say magical about this and truly mean that word, we're having these conversations, though. Catholic Church is not like, hey, look at our doctrine, and does this make sense for us now in the same way it made sense for us, I said 100 years ago, but Sam's point, 1,000 years ago, or however many years ago. There are not many religions that are looking at, I suppose it's because we don't have a creed, and saying, is this the right system of belief? Is this the right core of belief, I guess, more than the system? Many are having conversations about the processes, but they're not necessarily looking at the core. And I know it wasn't intentional because you wouldn't have known, Lynn, but I love that you have a shirt that says love that comes out of that right at the top, and to see that put forward into the beginning of this in such a different way, I think really speaks to what we're trying to do. I don't think these articles, if this proposed revision goes through, is going to get it 100% right, and it says that in it. It won't be right. It should be transformed. But moving love to the beginning of the values and covenant, to me, is absolutely the push of what we should be doing.
One of the commission members said that their feelings about the current Article 2 was that it needed more verbs, and that was one of the things they tried to be cognizant of in this proposal, is something that it becomes, the values become a little bit more actionable. Right, in a way that a lengthier principle is a little bit more intellectual, a little more heady, perhaps.
I have a queer Methodist minister friend who I'm talking to about coming and doing a talk, a sermon about out of her work with the trans LGBT community and the church's refusal to, because of tradition, that they won't. Her point is that the church has changed again and again and again and again and again without its history. We pretend like it hasn't. So I think we're going to have her come and talk about that. So it's kind of the same idea. Also, there's a requirement. You know what the period is for the requirement in the bylaws to revisit the principles?
Is it
every 20 or 30 years or something?
I don't remember the number, but yeah, that is sort of written in, is that, yeah, it is continually evolving.
Jewel, you were talking about there's conversation about making sure that we have more verbs involved in here. So as far as that inclusion piece of it, I don't see a lot in there about actively going against oppression of a group of people. You know, or working against oppression of any kind. Has there been any talk of that?
The verbs remark, I think, was them speaking specifically to the principles.
Right.
Yeah, that the values are more actionable than our current principles, was their feeling.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, the inclusion does not address, yeah, action, social action, per se.
Right. Okay. That was the question.
Yeah, it's in the part under Values and Covenant, the second paragraph that says we are accountable to one another for doing the work of living our shared values.
Yeah, now that I think about it, I do have one worry about this. And although the alternative I envision, not really an alternative, but this is a very identity politics document. And it positions us on a going forward basis firmly in an identity politics encampment. And it may very well be that the future of justice, the future of compassion, the future of lots of things may be much more classist. And that in that sense, we may become much more like Great Britain is. Does this document put us in a position of running the risk of, in the coming decades maybe, as being seen as sort of a more entrenched in the past? The reality in the future of this document may be that it is less forward-looking than it appears, because the concerns of Americans may evolve to be much, much more concerned about the economy, and this will be everybody will be concerned about that. It will not just be, it's not like it's going to be African Americans and people of color will still be concerned about that, but that it will be overwhelmingly. So that's the only worry I have about this document, that it may end up that the emphasis on identity politics is going to be yesterday's news, and people are going to be like, yeah, those Unitarians, look what they're concerned about. That's just, you know, who cares about that anymore?
Yeah, I would think, if I play devil's advocate, I think that the authors of this document would say that the values of generosity and equity and love would all encompass class as well, and classism. But that critique was also leveled against the eighth principle, that why race over, say, class or other issues. And the authors of the eighth principle acknowledged that were the eighth principle meant to be global, it would have to be probably dedicated class and gender issues. But in the United States, they felt like at this moment, race was our greatest issue. That was their argument.
And I just wanted to share that for all the climate geeks, or hopefully more than one, the interdependence in the words repair harm and damaged relationships.
I might comment on your issue with class, that Martin Luther King moved in that direction in his latter years to be more concerned about class and the poor than just about race.
One of our very powerful, influential ministers from South Africa, she goes by the single name of Thandeka, she's black, she's against the eighth principle for that reason, because she says class should be number one. Well,
and who was it over here? It was trying to.
Well, and I think, Neil, also we could make the counter argument that if that were to happen, if we quickly got eclipsed ideologically or morally, then it'd be time for another Article II.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, going back to the issue of race, one of the things that I think each of us individually needs to ask ourselves in our private moments is, do we really want to take the required actions necessary to attract people of different races to come here? Because that's an actionable step, or two or three, and it may place burdens on some of us that we just don't want to carry. And when I say we need to ask ourselves this in our private moments, it is because on the surface, we all want to appear as if we are inclusive, but do we really want to do the work that's required to actually be inclusive? One of the things that is a big issue in the Native American community currently is the difference between American Indians and Native Americans. And they're not necessarily the same group. All Native Americans are American Indians, but not all American Indians are Native Americans. And the reason why is there are so many people who, like members of my family, that were forcibly assimilated. They never were a part of the tribal system. They never got to have their name on the contract, and they don't receive any benefits. But their heritage is obvious. For a long time, I did not want to be photographed with my grandparents because they were obviously of Indian descent, me not so much, because I have one grandmother who is Caucasian. Very, very Caucasian. But she was the one person who kept the heritage alive after everybody else was forced to abandon it. And one of the big concerns I hear people of color complaining about is that the burden of being educated about their issues should not fall on their shoulders. That those of us who wish to include them in our groups should take on that burden to educate ourselves. And they'll say things like, well, there's this thing, you know, it's called, you know, the internet. If you really wanted to learn about us and how to include us, you'd look that up. On the other hand, living with one foot in both worlds all my life, I can say that we're all very busy. We all have a lot to do. There's not hardly a free moment where our thoughts are not preoccupied or having some issue presenting itself to us in real time that we need to attend to, making it difficult to remain focused on much of anything except, you know, just the current moment. But if we're waiting for somebody else to educate us, it probably won't happen. And at the same time, I understand how the focus in our own lives is spread out so much, it's hard for us to maintain it too. So I think what we have, as I was saying, I think what we have to do is ask ourselves, to what extent do we really want that? Do we just want to say it and look cool? Or do we really want to do it?
And to do it, we have to be open to change. And I can tell you as a minister, changing anything is a struggle. I got hassled at Muncie because one service I left the postlude off, which was, from a worship theory perspective, the totally right thing to do, but I changed it. It was different, and it was terrible, right? If we can't even deal with dropping off the postlude on one of our services, then how the hell are we gonna do with inviting in an African-American choir who's, right, worshiping in a way we're totally not used to and we're all freaked out, right? If we're going to embrace other cultures, other ways of thinking, other people, other subcultures, and so on, we have to be willing to change.
Thank you for that. The reason that I did the Martin Luther King sermon this year, I was reluctant to do it because I had been, my previous church had lost an interracial couple after a member did a Martin Luther King Day presentation, and not real well, and they never came back. So I was kind of reluctant to do it, but a former member and her spouse, and some, they're a biracial couple, I approached them about somebody to speak, and I think they passive-aggressively told me I should do it because they didn't respond. And I think it worked out well. And the other thing I would mention, I think this comes out of my transition when I decided I didn't want to transition from a man to a woman. I liked being in the middle. And that ends up becoming about change. And to me, being comfortable with change makes life an exploration rather than this kind of static thing. Anybody else?
Okay. So on that note, I'll offer some closing words and we'll turn things over to Allie for Somewhere Over the Rainbow. So continue to ponder this, continue to have conversations about that. We will soon, in fact, we just this week, the board and I got information about delegates, so we need to appoint our two delegates soon. The General Assembly is in Pittsburgh, I want to say June 23, 24, somewhere around in there, but you can also be a delegate virtually. And in past years, the congregation has been willing to pay the registration fee of its delegates. We haven't figured that out yet or even had a conversation about it, but that might happen. In past years, we've done that. So if you're interested, the congregation might...